You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Almost everyone has heard about the Church of Scientology and can probably even name some of its most famous members. But because of its culture of secrecy and traditional distrust of journalists, very little reliable information is publicly known about its inner workings. Janet Reitman, a contributing editor at Rolling Stone, has written what is claimed to be the first comprehensive and objective modern history of the self-help movement turned religion. Inside Scientology, the story of America's most secretive religion, is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And I am pleased to welcome Janet Reitman to our show today. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Didn't this book originate as an article that you wrote for Rolling Stone in 2005? Now, you were known as Rolling Stone's Iraq War Girl.
Yes, I was.
Was this another combat zone book?
It was a foreign culture. I spent it wasn't exactly a combat zone, but I spent a year covering the Iraq War, and prior to that, I'd done a lot of reporting in other countries. I spent a long time in the 90s reporting various stories in Africa, and actually it's a funny story that my boyfriend, when I started writing about Scientology for Rolling Stone and was trying to figure out how to get into it, he said to me, just look, pretend it's like the Sudan, you know, pretend it's just a foreign culture and look at it that way. And it was actually fantastic advice.
Well, what got you thinking about investigating Scientology?
Well, I was given the assignment by my editors to do this story, to investigate them. And, you know, it was during the period that Tom Cruise was jumping on couches and going on Matt Lauer. And, you know, he was sort of at the peak of his promotional swing. And we all thought, you know, what is it with this organization and what's behind this enthusiasm we're seeing? It was such a complete difference in Tom Cruise's behavior from, you know, the 2005, 2004, and, you know, sort of in the 90s when he used to actually get so angry if anybody brought up his religion that I gather he would walk out of interviews. So, or, you know, he would be very, very upset. So
he went from being very private to suddenly being very open about
it.
Well, you're right. If you take a look at the statistics, you might easily assume that Scientology is one of the most successful new religious movements in America. But why does it remain so controversial despite that?
Well, I mean, they have a wide variety of reasons. They're notoriously secretive. They've gone to court many, many, many times to protect their what they would call their trade secrets, which would be their secret teachings, their most exclusive or sacred teachings.
You can't imagine other religions doing that.
No. It's hard. It's pretty hard to think about that, yeah. No.
Well, it started as a self-help movement with L. Ron Hubbard's Dianetics. That was, as I remember, offered as an alternative to psychotherapy.
Yeah, it was. And it was an interesting period, actually, in American history because it was, you know, it was 1950 when Hubbard wrote Dianetics. And it was right at the, you know, the Cold War was sort of at its height. We were about to go in. We're going into the Korean War. And you had a lot of people who had come home from World War II. And I don't know how many people really understand the numbers of veterans of World War II. There was a huge swath of American men served in World War II. And many of these guys were back home, and they were from the middle class. They were educated. They were going to college on the GI Bill and whatever. And they were suffering from basically from PTSD. And psychiatry, and certainly psychoanalysis, psychotherapy, was not something that was popular. And it was very, very, very expensive. And it was really only available in cities like New York, you know, L.A., San Francisco, you know, sort of the cosmopolitan centers. But if you were out in the middle of the country somewhere and you were having really big issues from the war and you, you know, were having nightmares, you were having flashbacks, you needed something. And Dianetics presented itself as this alternative, and it caught on like crazy.
It was less expensive than psychotherapy.
It was free.
Didn't L. Ron Hubbard also have a thing about psychiatry? He claimed psychologists started the Holocaust.
Yes, he did. He saw psychiatrists as the evil, the ultimate enemy.
That because they were dismissing Dianetics as some kind of a fad? Pseudoscience?
No, they dismissed him as, and they dismissed Dianetics as pseudoscience, and they also dismissed, he felt that they dismissed him personally.
So let's go back. So what does Dianetics involve?
Dianetics involves basically analyzing or it's a lot like talk therapy. And it's basically looking at your traumas and exercising them. And it's basically regressive therapy. It's very Freudian in a certain way, but it's not Freudian.
So you go to somebody who's an expert in Dianetics. Is that what you did?
No. No, I went to the Church of Scientology in Manhattan. Uh-huh. And I got a little lecture and saw a video and met some people that said to me, you know, what are your problems? Why don't you take a personality test, which is what they offer you. You take a little, multiple choice test. And they
don't give you those cans and attach you to the e-meter
anymore? They did. Well, they didn't do that to me in New York. They did that. I went to Florida, actually, when I was doing very much, openly doing journalistic research. And they did try to give me this. They gave me this demonstration with the e-meter. It didn't work on me, but it does work for some people.
They say that you had nonspecific anxiety. What does that mean?
Don't we all have nonspecific anxiety? I don't know. Who knows?
Were you honest about what you were doing there?
No.
So maybe you were a bit anxious.
I was. Maybe I was. I mean, I had basically called a critic of the church, a kind of an expert in these kinds of organizations, and they explained to me how to go about this, which would be to not walk in there and completely lie and make up a story about myself, to be pretty truthful, but to not be 100% truthful, so that they wouldn't, immediately see me as a reporter. So I did. I went in. I was a writer. I went to Columbia for graduate school. I have a master's in journalism. I think I told them that I had an MFA from the writing program, not so far off. I was truthful about, where I lived. I was truthful about aspects of my personal life. And I told them I really wanted to quit smoking, which I did at the time. And, and all of these things made them warm to me and think that, and I also told them that I was kind of didn't need to work. That I was fairly financially set. And that was, of course, appealing because this is an organization that charges you for everything that you do. So.
Well, although the auditors were urging you to spend a lot of money on sessions to clear your anxiety, weren't you somewhat taken with the experience?
I was initially. I mean, I wasn't taken with the experience so much as I was not totally put off by it. And I went back to the magazine afterwards and I said to my editors, what's the big deal? To which they said, "Oh my God, and I said,
"You too."
You too. And but what that said to me actually was, "Wow, these people are amazing at sales." I'm not somebody who's very familiar with sales, and I realized, "Wow,
asking you for?"
Well, it's not about the money. They only asked me for $50, but they basically convinced me within a couple of hours there that, they might actually be able to help me. And they were making persuasive arguments like, well, how many people that take psychiatric drugs really, really, really get better? And I know many people that take psychiatric drugs. Some have gotten much better. Some people have not. How many people that are in therapy have really improved? And how long are they in therapy for? And some of these arguments can actually sort of embed themselves in your head a little bit. And you're like, huh, not that I was sold really by them, but I was interested in what they had to say. And if they could do that to me, who's a really cynical person, they can do that to lots of people.
My guest is Janet Reitman, who's written a book called Inside Scientology, The Story of America's Most Secretive Religion. Well, let's talk a bit about that secretiveness. It's pretty easy to find out an awful lot about Scientology today because all you have to do is go to the internet. And even some of the most arcane aspects of it are available. It's been parodied in the pop culture, for instance, on South Park. And I was wondering whether Parker and Stone couldn't have done a musical called The Book of Scientology and had as big a hit. But why do they insist on being secretive when people can find out pretty much everything anyway?
I think that's a really important point today. And I think that's one of their problems, actually, today, is that they can't keep these secrets. L. Ron Hubbard created Scientology, as I was saying, in the 1950s, during a very paranoid, secretive time. And
for him.
For him and for everybody. It was the Cold War, you know, sort of paranoia was in the air, I think.
But you say in his case he seemed to have been having real mental health
problems. He was having some mental health problems. He was clearly, you know, deeply afraid of psychiatrists, like I said before. You know, he felt personally attacked by them. He felt they thought his ideas were pseudoscience. But, you know, he had also gleaned certain things, it seems, from Western esoteric thought. And some of these esoteric faiths that were big in the early 20th century were based on secret knowledge, that you ascend the heights and then you as the higher and the higher you go, the more and more you learn until you reach a state of, you know, total knowledge and total awareness. And he believed very strongly that that was the carrot, you know. You keep having that carrot, and it was a way to get people to do it.
But it didn't start off that way. It started off as just Dianetics,
well,
didn't it? And then it went bankrupt?
Then it went bankrupt because L. Ron Hubbard initially was not the greatest businessman. And he lost control, basically.
But he was writing science fiction books. Was he making any money from that?
He was making not enough money from science fiction books. I mean, at the time, you know, Pulp Fiction was paying like a penny a word. He was making, I'm sure he was making more than that ultimately, but he was not really making a serious living, and he wanted to make, you know, not to kind of excuse L. Ron Hubbard for everything, but I think that for a man of that era, making money was a sign of success. It doesn't necessarily mean he was super greedy. Most of the people I interviewed told me that they didn't believe that he was very, very greedy until maybe a lot later in his life. But, you know, it was a sign of his success to make a lot of money. And he wanted to make a lot of money.
So he then creates Scientology, which really means the study of truth, doesn't it?
The study of truth. What happened was during Dianetics, people started to do it and have these, you know, the idea of Dianetics is to go all the way back into your past, to like go to the original incidents where you have this trauma and sort of exercise it, like I was saying.
You clear the blockages.
Yeah, you clear the blockages. Well, what people were doing was they were going back to birth, and then they were going back to the womb, and then they were going back to even before that. And people were having experiences where they were like in the 15th century. And that, or they were at least saying that they were, right? So that to L. Ron Hubbard said, this is spiritual. They're having, you know, past life experiences. This has a spiritual component, and that means it can be religion. And so he coined something that was, he dubbed a religion, and that he dubbed a spiritual science, quote unquote, and that was Scientology.
Now, some cynics have said that he had it declared a religion because then he could get tax-exempt status.
Yeah. Well, that was actually something that I, you know, some people that I interviewed who were part of the original Dianetic Scientology movement of the 50s specifically said to me that was their understanding even then, was that, you know, it was just for the purposes of tax that he wanted to be a religion.
But you say the question you're most often asked, is it really a religion? Is it a cult? Is it a... some kind of a psychology thing?
It's a corporation.
That's your answer.
It's a corporation. Whatever else you want to call it. It's so many things to so many people. I'm not going to say that it's not a religion because I know a lot of young people in their 20s who grew up with Scientology, and it's the only religion that they have ever known, and they have no concept of heaven or hell. They have no concept of prayer. They don't have any concept of what we would consider religion.
But couldn't you practice another religion and also be a Scientologist?
You could. You know, technically you could, but everybody tells me that once you get really into Scientology, you kind of can't. And certainly, I mean, the kids that I interviewed, and I interviewed dozens of kids for this book and for the magazine piece as well, the kids that I met, they were raised, their parents were usually Jewish or Catholic, and they didn't really celebrate those holidays anymore. I mean, you know, none of them told me they went to Passover Seders or celebrated, you know, Christmas or Hanukkah or anything like that. They were Scientologists.
My guest is Janet Reitman, who's a contributing editor at Rolling Stone, where her cover story, Inside Scientology, was a finalist for a National Magazine Award in 2007. And now there is a book with the same title, Inside Scientology, The Story of America's Most Secretive Religion. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Janet Reitman, who is a contributing editor at Rolling Stone, the author of Inside Scientology, The Story of America's Most Secretive Religion, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. There have been a lot of books, going all the way back to L. Ron Hubbard's own autobiography. Pretty much all of the books are by people who used to be in the group, who have since written books about how they came to be disillusioned. L. Ron Hubbard's own kid wrote one, didn't he?
He contributed to one. And then he ultimately took his name off of it, actually.
L. Ron Hubbard, Messiah or Madman?
Messiah or Madman, yeah, that was one of them.
And then more recently, there was that article in the New Yorker about Paul Haggis, the film director.
Mm-hmm.
And that really caused a big stir. But their response to all of these things is sour grapes.
Mm-hmm. The response to these books, well, the response to these articles anyway, is that, you know, that journalists rely on people who have access to Grind.
Mm-hmm. But isn't that a concern as well? If there are so many people who have access to Grind, that would suggest that there are problems within Scientology. Did they deny there were problems within the organization?
Yes, for the most part. They say that some of these people made it up.
For what reason?
Because they want money out of them. You know, some people in the past particularly had lawsuits against the church. You know, in my book and in my article as well, I really sought out people who were not suing Scientology, who were not going public. And you know what happened was ultimately, because it takes so long, some of these people did decide to go public. A lot of the people I interviewed were, 90% of them ultimately became very public, had websites, some of them self-published books, some of them spoke to Lawrence Wright for his article, some of them spoke to Anderson Cooper. The St. Petersburg Times did a fantastic series over a year and a half. A lot of my original sources, who were super hard to convince to go on the record, by the way, went on the record with these other sources, and you can't control that. But I, from my reporting, I wanted to find the most objective, the most balanced, the most the quietest people that I could, who could give me as close to what I would feel was a truthful account as I could.
And you have an epilogue here, which you've called What is True for You? And you get the feeling that the truth depends on who you're speaking to. This book could have been called Rashomon.
It could be. I mean, it really does. I mean, it's a very hard organization to pinpoint and say this is exactly what it is, because it is a lot of different things. And I definitely have met people who are Scientologists, particularly these young people, who I am so impressed by, and who are, you know, especially this one young woman who I write about, Natalie Ouellette, who grew up in Scientology. I've known her since she was 17. She's now 23, 24. She's off to law school next year, and she's fantastic. And I can't say this is, you know, she takes things from Scientology and, you know, sort of uses them in her normal everyday life. She had a very normal, what we call, quote unquote, normal growing up experience. She went to a big university. She was in a sorority. You know, she's not, and she had fantastic experiences. So I'm not going to say that this doesn't work for her.
Well, the problem for outsiders is they hear the stories. It goes beyond the Dianetics aspect, and the next thing you know, they're talking about past lives, and they're talking about thetans and all sorts of other things that sound very much like science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And then you wonder why intelligent people would suddenly start buying into something that sounds so fantastic.
One of the things about this is that it does not start off with the thetans and the Xenu myth, which is the creation myth that's been parodied everywhere.
And that's why Tom Cruise actually left Scientology for a while.
He apparently distanced himself from Scientology at around that time, and according to people that I interviewed that were around him at the time, it seemed to have something to do with that. A lot of people I've talked to had very really negative reactions to reading that, because what happens is it starts off as something else. It starts off as self-help, essentially. Therapy, community, self-help, you know, it starts off as a lot of things. And then it becomes a group activity. And by the time it becomes a serious group activity, you are now, you've invested a lot of your time, you've invested your money, this has become your whole community. And then you get to this point where you get to this level called OT3, where you read this story. And people have by this point paid, you know, roughly $100,000.
Unless they're celebrities.
Unless they're celebrities, in which case, you know, but celebrities are in a different category because they also give a lot of money. They donate money to various causes. But in terms of paying for the services, you know, $75,000 to $100,000 is essentially what I was told. That's a tremendous amount of money for most people. And they have also, in addition to their money, they have turned their life into Scientology. You know, everyone they know is basically in Scientology, and a lot of times their coworkers are Scientologists. So to not believe this stuff when everyone around you believes it, the peer pressure to believe it is so insane that, you know, people believe it.
And then they go along with his other, L. Ron Hubbard's other personal mm-hmm. beliefs. His hostility toward psychiatrists, toward medication, toward homosexuality, toward abortion, and, of course, to anyone who would leave the church.
Yes. The leaving the church issue is something that has caused big problems for a lot of people, because basically what Scientology says is that if you have a family member or friend who leaves the church on any kind of negative term, and particularly if they go public with, you know, their problems, like, you know, go on your show and talk about it, they're shunned. And you have to essentially what they call disconnect from them, which means cut off all contact.
So if if one person in a marriage starts questioning, mm-hmm. then the Scientologist will pressure the other spouse to get a divorce?
Yes. Yes. That's happened a lot. That's happened a lot. As a matter of fact, I mean, you know, allegedly, this is essentially what happened with Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman. Was she lost interest in Scientology. He gained tremendous interest in Scientology. He had to be with somebody who would be, you know, at that same place with him. And, yeah, they divorced. And, I mean, this happened to many, many, many people that are in the church.
Well, aren't they disturbed at all by all the stories of harassment? There was a scandal over espionage at one point.
Yes. Scientology had a covert they had their own spy service. And they actually had a lot of members who were trained as almost like amateur spies. And these were like kids who, you know, 20-something-year-old kids who would break into government offices or get themselves jobs working for various agencies so they could find information about that these agencies might have been collecting on Scientology, take them, Xerox them, share them with the church, put the originals back. And the church there, you know, by that would build this big file of information, and they would know what everybody else knew about them, and they would figure out ways to counter attacks. It was a form of defending themselves because they were constantly under investigation, like all over the world. So, but yeah, it's pretty wild. L. Ron Hubbard was a spy master.
Although they thrive in this country, there are some countries that actually ban Scientology.
Yeah. Yeah. They've been banned in,
Germany most notably.
Germany, Russia just banned all books written by L. Ron Hubbard. Not sure if that includes his science fiction, but definitely all Scientology-oriented books have just been banned in Russia. They've had huge legal battles with the French. They've had problems in the past in England. They were banned in Australia. It's very fluid, the bans, but they've had a lot of problems all over the world.
My guest is Janet Reitman of Rolling Stone. Her book, Inside Scientology, The Story of America's Most Secretive Religion, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One of the more disturbing and confusing aspects of Scientology seems to be the way they use language. For instance, ethics comes to mean the ability, quote, to improve conditions for the good of the church. Therefore, something as insignificant as holding an unsuccessful fundraiser or feeding Tom Cruise shrimp that caused him to get food poisoning, and that's something that actually happened, isn't it? Becomes
apparently
unethical.
So. That was an ethical breach on this one poor church employee's fault. And, you know, I think she was punished for that. Yeah.
There have been claims that people have been physically abused.
Yes, there have been lots and lots of those claims. And I have talked to many, many people who have made those allegations. And it's a tough thing because those claims have tended to be regarding what goes on in the church's innermost core at its base in the desert where the head of the church resides and where all his senior staff is. And, you know, that is such a secure place and you know, just in the way that the church is, it is at that level so controlling that there is, if you were to be assaulted, you would not call 911. You would not go to a doctor. You would not call the police. So there is no actual evidence that this has happened to these people. But there's, you know, I mean, the reports are overwhelming.
Well, haven't a number of people died during the auditing process?
There is one woman in particular who I write a lot about who died having had a nervous breakdown.
Lisa McPherson.
It's a very famous story that happened in the 90s in Clearwater, Florida, which is the church's sort of ecclesiastic hub. And she had been essentially driven crazy by the pressure of doing Scientology, having to make money for Scientology, working for people who were Scientologists and you know sort of her she was a classic example of someone whose entire life was about Scientology. She suffered a breakdown in the middle of the street in Clearwater, downtown Clearwater. Was brought to a hospital. Was put under psych. Initially looked at by a sort of a nurse with psychiatric training. And the church was very fearful that she would be put under actually like a psychiatric watch. And they convinced her because that would have then, you know, been a huge deal because the psychiatrists, like we've said, are the enemy. So they convinced her to sign herself out, and she signed herself out against her doctor's advice, put herself in the care of church officials who installed her at the Fort Harrison Hotel, which is the church's hub in Florida, and she was there for 17 days and she died.
And that involved David Miscavige, who is the new head of the church or the man who took over after L. Ron Hubbard died?
David Miscavige reportedly oversaw the process that Lisa McPherson was put under, which is called the introspection rundown. She was given he was given daily reports, allegedly, on her treatment. He had also, apparently overseen her auditing, supervised the auditing that she was doing prior to her breakdown, where she was declared clear. He actually declared that she was clear, which was this great achievement. This is one of the levels that you get to in Scientology, which is sort of a goal for every sort of ordinary, normal member. And you know, he had some control over that. And so, yes, there was a...
A listener asked about the church's view of homosexuality. I mentioned earlier L. Ron Hubbard had hostility toward homosexuality. There were rumors that a number of the more famous members were gay and perhaps joined to be cured. Is there a process by which people are cured?
To my knowledge, no. I know a guy that joined to be cured, and he went all the way up to the very top and didn't get cured and actually sued the church because he hadn't been cured. But Scientology is not unlike, say, certain evangelical Christian groups. They don't make their sort of statement on like homosexuality or other social issues. They're not an organization that's about this sort of social issues. And so, yes, there are lots of people that are in Scientology who are gay. A sort of healthy membership that are gay, but they have to suppress that if they're going to be in Scientology because it's looked at as an aberration, as a flaw. And they basically go through the auditing that everybody goes through, and that's one of their key flaws they're trying to get rid of.
You were able to interview a number of apostates, ex-Scientologists. Many of them shared truly horrifying and deeply personal stories about their involvement in the church, although they'd never talked about them publicly before. Is that because they're embarrassed, or do they feel like they're betraying the church on some level? There are many people who leave churches with good reason and yet feel that they've done something wrong.
Yeah, a lot of them did feel that way. A lot of them also didn't want to speak out because they still have family in the church. They have friends in the church.
Did they fear reprisal?
A lot of them feared reprisal. A lot of them feared reprisal.
Now, we know about Scientology and Dianetics, but aren't there a number of other organizations that we don't know about that are connected to Scientology?
Yes, they have a number of sort of social betterment organizations, we could say, that are there to spread their message in the secular world. So they have a drug rehab program, a series of clinics known
That's
as
Narcanon.
They're all over the world. They have a whole educational agenda and a curriculum, and it's called Applied Scholastics. And so anything with an Applied Scholastics brand has a link to the Church of Scientology.
And are they being used in schools around the country?
They are being used in Scientology schools that Scientologists are very, you know, sort of run. But some of their techniques have been used in literacy programs that have been covered by federal funding. They've gotten No Child Left Behind money for some of their tutoring programs, after-school tutoring programs. They in the state of Illinois, actually Nancy Cartwright, who's a big member of the church, the voice of Bart Simpson, she was pushing for a morals agenda called the Way to Happiness to be integrated into the Illinois public school system curriculum. And they considered it, and it went all the way up to the legislature, and it was it was recently struck down when they found out, apparently, that it was connected to Scientology, but they didn't really understand it originally that it was connected to Scientology, and many of these guys didn't think anything was wrong with it. So it was interesting, you know, that they immediately sort of said, oh, it's with Scientology, and they shut it down. But a lot of the morals they sort of thought were basic. But yeah, this is their technique of getting into society.
Hasn't Scientology also been largely white?
Yes, but they do, you know, they're reaching into the African American community now. It's really interesting. Their leadership, their hierarchy is largely white. But they have made this great outreach to the Nation of Islam, of all things, and it's worked. And Louis Farrakhan has apparently embraced Dianetics, and even recently instructed his top leaders to read Dianetics and to do some Dianetics courses, or else that they couldn't be leaders of the nation. It's bizarre, but interesting. It's very interesting.
On the other hand, there's been so much pushback. You suggest that the only way Scientology will be able to expand is for it to reform. How would it reform?
I think it has to stop being so punishing. I think it has to stop disconnection. It has to stop being so expensive. And I think it has to stop being so doctrinaire, if it can possibly do that. It's one of the most absolute faiths I've ever heard of. You cannot question it. You cannot question the word of L. Ron Hubbard. You cannot discuss or debate it. And no religion grows and evolves without debate or discussion. And it's you know, and in terms of sort of if you want to think about what fundamentalism means, and meaning very fundamental, absolute interpretation, that's what Scientology is, and it cannot survive and evolve and thrive without there being real discussion and debate and sort of a lively community of that. And right now, as it is, it doesn't have that.
Near the end of his life, Hubbard claimed to be the reincarnation of the Buddha. I think Buddha would have been a lot more open to discussion and debate.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Thank you so much for coming by to discuss it with us.
Thank you, Janet
Reitman, who is a contributing editor at Rolling Stone and also has written for many other publications and covered the Iraq War, also reported on conflicts in Sierra Leone, Sudan, Haiti, and Zimbabwe. Her book, Inside Scientology, The Story of America's Most Secretive Religion, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much.